This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA plus community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Saturday Magazine, sponsored by Velocity Rewards,
the award-winning loyalty program for Virgin Australia's frequent flyers.
Hey, you. Yeah, you, in the car. Did you know that over half of the people who listen to Joy are allies of the LGBTIQ plus community, just like you? So you may not be aware, but times are really tough financially at Joy, and we're reaching out for your support. So tell your siblings, your workmates, heck, even wind down your window and tell someone else stuck in the traffic to head over to joy.org.au and help us build Joy Nation by making a donation. Joy, your voice, your radio station.
A unique mix of world news and queer culture. Saturday Magazine, every Saturday, 10 till 12 on Joy 94.9.
Saturday Magazine, Joy 94.9, Macca and Tass. Misha Ketchell has just arrived on into the studio. We'll let him get his stuff together.
Powder his nose, so to speak.
Yeah. I've got it in my hand sanitizer.
This yes, yes, yes.
I've always hated hand sanitizer as an idea.
Whereas now you search it out.
Get used
well,
to it.
Apparently soap is still better.
So. Oh, it is. Yeah. But, you know, we don't have a wash basin and everything at the front desk, so...
Yeah. Mr. I spent Wednesday sort of touring hospitals and by the end... My hands felt like they had a layer of sticky over them.
Yes. Yeah. A bit like glue, you know.
Yeah, it was a bit too much. Yeah. So I had to go off into find a bathroom and give them a good soap and wash and get it all off again. But I know what you mean.
Yeah. What's the active ingredient? Is it like alcohol that actually is the key thing?
I've got no idea.
It has to be at least 60% alcohol to be effective.
Oh. I remember not long ago I was in the US and
if you lick it, would that be
they sort of had this real culture where everyone used hand sanitizer all the time. They had them like at the bottom of all the sort of banisters on stairs.
Yes. Look at Macca's belt.
Really? Has he got hand sanitizer? There you go.
That's in case I come in close contact with anyone.
Excellent.
Macca, I reckon that's weird.
It's not weird. That was given to me by my partner. Because he said, oh, you know, you'll be around a lot of people today. So if you want to sanitize your hands, there you go.
Misha, good to see you again.
Good to see you all.
We've been trying to second guess what sort of issues you might like to talk about. But before we do that, you know, we have already done a bit of an intro around coronavirus, and I was just interested in what some of your high-level takeouts might be about the way in which the federal government is now coming to respond and try to, re-stimulate the economy and support the community in its transition through the coronavirus.
Re-stimulate? What, you think they've already stimulated it before?
Okay, stimulate.
Yeah.
Okay. It's a really interesting question. Actually, I was just reading this morning a fantastic piece by Mike Seckham in the Saturday paper that was talking about this very important issue of trust around government responses to things like the coronavirus. And he was talking about the fact that really since the last major stimulus package, which was the GFC stimulus package under Wayne Swan, the sort of conservative side of politics has really spent the past 10 years talking that down, saying it was sort of, you know, socialist, you know, welfare and terrible and disastrous. So one of the first questions that you face is the question of credibility. If that is your position and you don't believe in stimulus, how can you now suddenly have a stimulus that is modelled in a very similar manner? And Seckham really went into, I think, a really interesting discussion of the broader theme of trust. Trust in institutions, trust in experts, trust in government. And again, the role really of people sort of on the, you know, conservative or the right side of politics in sort of talking that down. So he talked about the fact that conservatism used to be based around this idea of actual sort of faith in institutions, faith in systems, you know, talking up things like, you know, universities, experts, you know, churches, the police, law and order, government. And basically talked about the fact that, you know, on the right of politics, really for, you know, 10, 20 years now, there's been a concerted campaign to, wherever it's convenient, really talk down institutions, talk down trust, talk down the capacity of government. Now, when you're in government and then you're doing things like launching a response to coronavirus or trying to launch economic stimulus... But you've spent the past 10 years saying government can't do stuff, government should be out of your life, it actually creates a problem. There's a trust, trust deficit there. I think it's a really, really interesting point because we sort of are at this moment now where, you know, a group of people who are very hostile to government intervention are championing government intervention. People who have been hostile to experts and listening to experts are saying, we will only listen to the experts. You'll see now how Morrison is spending so much time with Brendan Murphy, you know, the chief medical officer. So,
but he's a scientist.
It's really interesting. Well, that's right. And, I mean, look, in some ways...
He's a doctor, actually.
You know, we
Oh, yes, but medicine is based on science.
That's right. But in some ways, I think we shouldn't be... You know, that it's a welcome development in one sense. Like, it's great that, you know, finally the government is wanting to be seen to be listening to scientists. That's a really good thing. It just is jarring given what we've seen, you know, you know, in the past sort of 10 years or so.
You know, I thought, you probably watched, I'm sure you, you know, would have read it, Donald Trump, US president, declaring a national emergency. And as he said that, you know, two very big words, right? Two very big words, national emergency. Well, I've got two words for you, Donald. You are ridiculously dystopian.
Okay.
Well, tell us what you really think, Macca.
Yeah, I mean, you know, again, the criticism, and this is also dealt with in the second article I was reading this morning, was the number of, you know, factually inaccurate claims from Trump. I think it's something like 16,000 now, some huge number. And the way in which, you know, he was throwing shade on the importance of this particular, you know, the coronavirus when it started. And there's an interesting little side discussion about the latest, you know, the one before this, which was the swine flu. And again, there were people in the... sort of conservative side of politics, the American right, for example, who were very critical of the response to swine flu and were sort of talking it down and saying it wasn't necessary. So again, you get this thing where if you're giving contradictory messages, it's very, very hard for people to know what to think at a time when the thing that people need more than anything else is actual clarity.
Hey, you know, we've just had a question from a listener. It's actually a statement saying MQFF, the Melbourne Queer Film Festival, which launched on Thursday night, or opened on Thursday night, they're arguing that there's still been no comment from the organisers on their response to the coronavirus.
Well, I'd actually had...
That's actually not correct.
No, it's not correct. I'd had an email.
I've had two.
A couple of emails.
Yeah, one per day.
And there is a statement on their website. So I encourage you to have a look at the website.
That's 705, Macca.
Yeah, so 705, the last three digits. Have a look on their website. Yeah, because they have actually... made a statement and said what they're doing.
And they've provided some guidance and guidelines for people attending films.
Yeah, as Joy have internally to our...
Well, I think everybody has a responsibility
our memberships
to.
And volunteers. Do you think, Misha, I think, you know, the point you make is really interesting that, you know, governments have said, no, we don't, you know, prime the economy, we don't give money to people, blah, 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 all of this, and then all of a sudden they're doing it. You know, it's like when... You know, the National Party, you know, are great advocates of privatisation, except they want the government to open a coal-fired power station. So you can understand why people go, you know, I just don't believe you. You're not authentic. You're about as authentic as a $3 note.
Yeah, I think that's right. And that's where we get the problem of confusion. And that's where, when there are really important messages that are coming from the government now... around what people need to do and how we want people to behave, it's much harder to expect people to take that stuff on trust and behave with confidence based on those messages. So there's quite a bit of work to do there. I mean, it's interesting, you know, and it's difficult. It's a very quick-moving situation. I mean, as of partway through yesterday, Scott Morrison was going to the footy on the weekend. Now he's not. The Grand Prix was going to go on for a long time and it was, you know, shut very late. All the evidence from the experts does say that this sort of approach, this sort of harder line, more preemptive approach, is actually the right approach. I don't know if you discussed it yet, but the phrase that everyone's talking about is the flattening the curve idea.
Yes.
Yeah.
And the idea is that we're going to get a certain number of infections no matter what, but if they will come in a very, very high spike, if you're going to graph it, the difficulty with that is it places a really a huge strain on the health system. So it's far better to take all of these measures now that we are taking to basically slow the rate of infection.
Yeah. So I heard the state epidemiologist speak on Wednesday evening, and he argued that 80% of people who are infected with the virus will probably be able to continue on with their work. They'll have some mild signs and symptoms, but it won't be debilitating. 20% will form an illness, and 5% of those will require intensive care.
Yeah.
That's the group that we're concerned about. And if you look at what's happening in Italy at the moment, intensive care physicians have got together and said, the demand is so great, we cannot cope. We have to find a line somewhere. And they've used age.
Yeah.
Anybody over this line will not have access to intensive care and will likely die.
Oh, God, I didn't know about that.
That's very, very extraordinary.
It's shocking. And actually, again, it's interesting because I have heard some discussion about this idea that when you face a situation of crisis, it does actually sort of amplify or highlight social inequality. And definitely there's an aspect in which our response to this has to be about those who are most disadvantaged and most vulnerable. Young people are at very low risk, you know, children, teenagers, they might get the illness, but their capacity to survive it is very high.
As of Wednesday night, there had not been a single recorded death of a person under the age of 9.
Yeah. That's right, yeah. And I think, you know, in the younger age group overall as well, I mean, if you look at the graph, really until you get to about the ages of sort of over 60 and really over 70 and over 80, the mortality rates are quite low and then it shoots up. But also people who have other vulnerabilities, whether it be chronic illnesses, other forms of disadvantage, will also be more vulnerable. And so this is a situation where, again, our sort of response as a society needs to be, in my view, targeted at protecting those who are most at risk.
It does. So, Misha, in terms of where the conversation is going, and we've seen the closure of AAP, or the imminent closure of AAP, and Benjamin Priest from The Age, we spoke about it at a bit of length last week. It seems to me that Channel 9 and News Corp's are deliberately not allowing bids. People interested in perhaps buying AAP?
It's very interesting. The official line from Campbell Reid, who's the chairman of AAP, has been that they're certainly open to offers.
Now, he's a News Corp person, isn't he?
Yes, he is. That's right. Because it's jointly owned by News Corp and Fairfax and a couple of others. Australian Community Newspapers is one.
Yeah.
Australian Community, and there's one other, I think. Yeah. But, yeah, so...
Well, of course they're open to offers, but, you know, we all are, but, you know...
It's very interesting because if you look at the financials last year, AAP actually recorded a small surplus. So the extent to which it's in sort of dire financial straits now, and all the reports are that it is in quite dire financial straits,
yeah.
It sort of seems somewhat sudden. And, you know, I guess some people are somewhat sceptical about what's going on. The key issue that's being raised by critics is that AAP really allows diversity in media in Australia.
Because it does.
By providing its service, it allows niche players to be able to come into the market and have some sort of, you know, sort of strength to rely on in terms of breadth of reporting. And then if you've got a small team, you can focus on specialised areas. I think it's really interesting. The Guardian's a really good example. It came into Australia. It really focused on issues that were at the core of what The Guardian wanted to do. So climate change, Indigenous affairs, asylum seeker policy. Because it had such a small team. I think when it started, Guardian Australia would have had, you know, maybe about 20 journos. And I don't think it's hugely more than that now. So, you know, to be able to have a big impact with a small team, something like AAP is hugely important. There is some people who are sort of saying that they're ascribing some sort of anti-competitive motivation to News Corp and Fairfax, you know, the owners of AAP. I'm not sure about that. I think that might be just drawing a slightly long bow. I think it is just a case of it's an expensive business. They are subsidising it to a very large extent. They've decided it would be easier and better just to bring that in-house and just hire people in-house, and they're undertaking to do that. You know, I think it's sort of hard to know exactly where it will go. I think the key thing is it is a big problem for Australian media because it will impact on strength and diversity, and because AAP played such an important role in being the source of factual information. The reality of the business media model now is that the way that you attract attention is you hire a high-profile journalist or commentator or columnist, whether it be on a radio station or on TV or in print. You build an audience around that work. you create a conversation that is noisy enough in a very competitive marketplace to get attention. What is very hard about the business model for any media is actually that going out to the press conference, checking the facts, transcribing what somebody said, going to the court, going to the local council meeting, making sure that you attend all the events where you need to have a photographer present. For example, for the conversation, we are subscribed to the IAP photo service. And now that, you know, if that's going to be unwound, we're thinking about what we will do.
What would you do?
I mean, could we afford to hire one photographer potentially? Would that work? It would be very difficult. You've got one photographer, there's 20 or 30 news events around Australia that you want to go to, and one of them or two of them might produce a really good photo that you actually need for your coverage. So the idea that you can use one photographer to cover something, it just doesn't stack up. You actually need a scale of a service like AAP. So it's a real loss in terms of reporting as the act of actually gathering accurate information. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's 180 journalists and around 600 staff that are going to be lost.
Jeez,
it's a massive blow.
I'm thinking, a lot of the online is the stories are clickbait. Someone actually asked me about the conversation the other day. What's that? And I said it's actually fact bait.
I'm glad you said that. I mean, that's sort of what we're aiming to do is, you know...
That's what you do, isn't it?
Yeah. And one of the things that's really important, for example, right now, we were talking before about the ways in which politicians, by talking down governments and the institutions that they actually work within, have actually eroded trust. So people are less inclined to trust them than they used to be. What we're trying to do is the opposite, which is rebuild trust. We're just trying to produce factually reliable, accurate information, explanatory information.
Evidence-based.
Some of it, you know, you might say it's sort of more workmanlike in the sense that it's actually just focusing on the information itself, doesn't have the bells and whistles, it's not dressed up. But it's to try to provide somewhere where if you want to go to find something that is reliable, this is a place you can go.
It's a great service, Macca.
It is. So why have you bought the Herald Sun, Misha?
I haven't. That's actually The Age, but it's just The Age is now a tabloid.
That's right. Yeah.
So yes, but you know, I keep an eye on the Herald Sun every now and then.
You have to, really, don't you? If you're interested in current issues and currency, you have to.
Look, and also, you know, when I judge journalism awards and, for example, the Herald Sun last year won the Quill Award for its coverage of the Nicola Gobbo Lawyer X scandal, and there was some extraordinary work they did. And there was some great pursuing that with FOI against attempts to sort of cover it up. I mean, you know, there's lots of things we can say that are critical about the coverage in the Herald Sun, and I think they're valid. But you need to sort of do both. You need to be really highly critical, but also give them credit where it's due.
Now, have we got time for another topic?
I just wanted to ask, so Samantha Maiden has moved to news.com.au.
Has she?
Yeah, okay. I think so.
Who is she? Who is she, Macca?
A journalist, very accomplished journalist. In fact, it might actually mean that it might actually be news.com.au rather than just the clickbait.
Well, that's right. She's a very good, very experienced press gallery reporter. A lot of years. And she's one of those ones who's very robust and very much on the side of the reader, which is great. There was some scandal, I forget the details of it, from some years ago where she reported something which, you know, the politician said that she shouldn't have. And she's actually a very forthright reporter. I think it's good.
She's got a great network and sources.
Yeah, absolutely.
She's very good at that. Sorry, Tash, you wanted to...
Oh, well, I just thought, are there any developments or any further analysis around the sports rorts story?
Well, that was one I did want to talk about because obviously it's been overshadowed by, quite properly by, COVID-19. But it is interesting, this question that's arisen really in the past.
Thank God for natural disasters sometimes, huh?
Well, that's right. They do say for the politicians, never waste a crisis. And I think Scott Morrison's been working very hard on that. But this week he has also spent some time avoiding, sidestepping, declining to answer questions about his office's role in the changes to the spreadsheet of who was going to get what in the sports funding allocation. And those changes... it's been confirmed were made after the minister had signed off on the sheet. So actually it now raises a whole bunch of questions
about
who did it? Who made the changes?
Was it the cleaning lady that came in and decided that her daughter's basketball club should get some funding? I mean, who did it?
Well, that's question number one. Number two is there's a really strong legal framework around ministerial responsibility. Who can sign off on these things?
Well, in it's written down. Whether it's actually followed is another matter.
That's right. So it's a look, it's a really interesting question for the government. Again, just going back to this question of trust, I think, you know, to some extent people are quite cynical about the ways in which governments spend money. But this is, this really goes to the core of trust. This is taxpayer money that is supposed to be spent in the best interests of the public. There's a whole lot of evidence that it wasn't. We now know that. It seems that there is increasing evidence that the Prime Minister's office was involved in these late changes, which raise a whole bunch of important questions. And the Prime Minister is just not answering the questions, which I think is astonishing.
It's a bigger trough than the sewerage pond at Werribee.
Yeah, it's a real problem. And it's interesting as well.
But that aside, I think you're right, Misha. The issue is the behaviour is now different.
Yeah.
We're now getting this sort of level of arrogance and avoidance and not preparedness to participate in a public discussion about it.
And also, I mean, there's a more worrying general pattern of not feeling a responsibility to come clean and be transparent with the Australian public, whether it be about the trip to Hawaii. And, I mean, there were basically blatant lies told about where the Prime Minister was. About that pastor who was, invited to the Oval Office.
That was gossip.
It was dismissed. It was dodged. And then suddenly it was put out. I just think there is something about understanding your role of accountability to the public when you are, you know, the Prime Minister of a country. It seems to me that the way in which Scott Morrison is handling that is different to previous Prime Ministers. Now, politicians will always answer the question they wish they'd been asked. There's always a level of spin or obfuscation to some extent. It just seems to have taken it to a new level. And I think that these are questions which are important enough that they have to be answered. And I think it's a watch this space. I can't see any of the reporters who are on this dropping off it. And I think this is one that will sort of simmer along. And it's just worth continuing to watch.
I think I'd get, you know, if I was in, you know, in the room when the Prime Minister's having a press conference and you ask the question, and he doesn't answer it. I know there's a protocol around this and whether it's Lee Sales or David Spears or, you know...
But even in Parliament, Macca, I mean, we're getting one-word responses to detailed, complex issues.
Like, I almost feel like saying, well, if I was, you know, the journalist there asking the question, I'd say, no, you'd end up saying, why don't you answer the bloody question? Like, what is the problem with answering the question?
Yeah.
And, you know, I sometimes, you know, and I'm not blaming the journalists. I understand, you know, there's a protocol and there's a, you know, and it has to be about respect. But at the end of the day, you almost think, well, hang on, what's the point of interviewing these people some of the time when you don't actually get an answer?
There's a line because I think the public feel that the hyper-combative interviews, they're often very critical of them and they can turn people off. So as a journalist, you sort of are stuck in the damned if you do, damned if you don't sort of situation. I think a lot of people do a really great job. There was a great Lee Sales interview recently. I'm trying to think who it was.
I'm in love with Lee Sales.
Or it was Morrison. I think it was the Morrison one where she did pursue him very hard on a few things.
She did.
And I think just getting that line exactly right is tricky. I think the thing to note is that the journalists who are following this sports rorts issue will continue to follow that issue, and I think that more will come out.
Yeah. I mean, we've had instances in this studio where we haven't got, you know, answers to reasonable questions, and we've almost felt that we want to turn their microphone off or tell them to leave, you know.
And I think there's a way in which...
It might happen one day, Tess.
There is a way in which you can say, look, that wasn't the question I asked, and you can follow up. But there is a point at which, you know, it's very hard to know what to do.
Well, I mean, I find the behaviour very interesting. I find the behaviour almost aggressive and standoffish. And I look at people like Lee Sales and Patricia Cavallis, and I absolutely love all those journalists, and I think they do a great job. But they end up being the fall guy, and they end up being attacked doing their job.
Because the behaviour of the politicians and also some business people, it is dystopian. It's just, it's ridiculous.
Oh, I think our federal politicians at the moment are taking the cake, Macca.
Yeah, and, you know, look, there are examples of it in state governments, you know, Labor and Liberal as well, but not at the same level.
This is
at a new level and I despair a bit at it, to be honest.
Now, Macca, we're rabbiting on. We are. Misha, we're almost out of time, unfortunately. I always love our conversations on air.
You can hang around. You don't have to go.
Okay, I've got to go and wash my hands again now, haven't I?
You do too. What's on for the rest of your day?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I'm one of those people who is trying to continue on pretty much as normal. So I went out for drinks with colleagues last night and...
bit of terps.
You know? Not a bit of terps, but a couple of drinks. Not on the terps. I'm going to try to have a pretty normal day, but it's going to be sort of a day at home with the family, you know. I don't know, doing things like, you know, cleaning out the cupboards or something. I don't know. There's not much we can go
to.
We're
going to a 70th tonight.
Are you?
A 70th. How does that crept into my network? 70.
Oh, darn. Well, you're closer to that than you are to 50.
So if there's more than 100 people, that's not ideal thing.
Well, you know, I have a friend who's turning 60 shortly, and her partner's seriously debating cancelling her birthday party.
Really? God. Mm.
I don't think we're quite at that spot.
There's not
enough people around who are infected yet. Mind you, we don't know.
Yeah,
because the incubation period is, you know, between 2 and 14 days, so you just don't know.
I think at the moment we're about 200 confirmed cases in Australia. That's the number that I heard. Yeah. So it's not huge.
We had 9 new cases yesterday alone.
Yeah. Well, we're out of time, Misha. I know you've got to get home, and your family are eagerly awaiting for you to arrive so they can start cleaning out the cupboards.
Yes.
It's always interesting what you find. It's like when you move house, you find all this stuff you didn't know you had.
Great to see you again. Right.
Thank you.
So thanks again. Thanks for your work at The Conversation. It's a really, really important facility for us all to access evidence-based journalism.
Saturday Magazine is proudly sponsored by Velocity Rewards, the loyalty program of Virgin Australia.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.